Are you looking to launch and level up your career in international education? Well, look no further than the Global Pro Career Institute. This is our online career development program that covers it all, from articulating your compelling brand and signature story to strategically stacking your body of work and growing a powerhouse network of champions. This program will help you become a dream job magnet in global education. The strategies I teach aren't just theory. In fact, it's a proven framework that I've used over the past two decades to land highly competitive jobs, go from intern to executive in 4 years, and get headhunted by numerous companies. Join over 500 students who have learned how to master the big three: their resume, cover letter, and LinkedIn profile. Our students have gone on to stand out in a very crowded job market, land on the elusive yes pile of resumes, and wow hiring teams with their tailored, authentic, and purpose-driven applications. The Global Pro Career Institute is the only career development program for aspiring global educators, meaning you don't already have to have a job in the field to get started. If you're ready to jumpstart your career in global education and skip to the front of the line, enroll in the Global Pro Career Institute and dive right into the content. I promise you won't regret it. Go to insidestudyabroad.com/GPI to get started, and I'll see you on the inside.
You know, it's okay, I think, to make lateral moves or moves down if it's helping you get on that next S curve, right? This curve is going to keep going up for me, and I know that, and that's why I made that decision.
Everyone, and welcome back to the Inside Study Abroad podcast. This is episode number 41, and this show is all about helping you launch and level up your career in international education and meaningful travel. And today we have a very special episode. We haven't done this before. We realized when we were going through some ideas for future episodes, but Sam has never been interviewed on the podcast. So today, very special treat. I'm interviewing the lovely Sam Cooper about her career trajectory in international education and how she got here and all the things. So how are you doing, Sam?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
It's so funny. Like once we hit record, we're both like, hi. But normally we're like, whatever. So let's start off like I do every interview and tell us your international education story.
Sure. So I think my story really starts how I imagine lots of people's stories start, with actually studying abroad. So I went to UC Santa Barbara, where the Gauchos, I don't know why I said that, I was never into sports there, but I had the opportunity to do the education abroad program. So I did a year in France during my junior year. So at the time, a very traditional study abroad program. And whilst I was studying there, I had a program coordinator who was French and amazing. And I just fell in love with her and I wanted to be her. You know how that happens when you study abroad and you see someone in that culture and you're then aspire to be them. Well, I just fell in love with this cute, wonderful, amazing French lady. And I just wanted to be her. I loved how helpful she was. And so when I went back to campus the year after for my senior year, I applied to be a peer advisor in the study abroad office. And that's really how I started, and haven't really looked back since. So I started as a peer advisor. I did that my senior year. And I'm very lucky to be a dual citizen with the UK. I'm really sorry. I'm married now too, so I can't marry you to give you this dual citizenship.
I know. And every time I'm like, does Alan have a brother?
He does, but he's partnered up.
Yeah, I know. It's fine.
And so after my senior year, I moved to London without a job. And it was a week after 9/11, which is crazy. And I just started job hunting and I ended up getting a job at Chelsea College of Art and Design, working as an international registrar. So working with the international incoming students that came to do really foundation years or their first year at the university. That's kind of how it started.
Pause. Okay. Sorry. I didn't know if you were going to keep going. And like, I was like, no, we need to go back. I have questions. So For you, even though I know you were a dual, you are, and have always been a dual citizen, but what lit your spark for even wanting to study abroad in the first place? Where did that inspiration come from? Did you travel a lot growing up?
I was always obsessed with it. And I think because my dad's British and my mom's American, we would travel to England, for example. But I think it really started with my dad took my brother and I, both when we turned 13, to Paris. Which is really romantic, isn't
that
it?
That is so sweet.
I know. So when it was my turn, we went to Paris and spent, I can't even remember how many days, but then traveled to the UK to visit our family there. And I remember my dad trying to teach me certain French phrases to get by and being terrified that I wouldn't be able to say them. I think one of them he taught me was jokingly, but he did teach it to me, was how to tell the cab driver, my father's drunk, take me to the hotel.
Oh, old David Cooper
for you. And I think from there, we went and I practiced a little bit of French, you know, asking people for to buy stamps. I remember that was a phrase, and where the toilets were. And I just thought, I really want to learn this language. This is amazing. So that was the nugget. That was
yeah.
The part.
That's yeah. Awesome. Yeah. And so then you studied French in college.
I did.
How's your French these days?
So it's been about 20 years. It's okay. I love languages. And I'm obsessed with them, but it doesn't mean I'm great at them. I wish I kept it up. When I go back, I can speak a little bit and it becomes more comfortable. But I did also then learn Spanish. So right now, my Spanish is probably a little bit better than my French. And when I go back when I visit Spain or Latin America, that comes back a lot quicker. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's just a jumble there.
Yeah.
But I didn't make languages my lifelong work, but part of me wishes I had. That would be a whole career.
Oh yeah. That would be me. I love languages, but I'm horrible. I think it's because I have the worst memory. Like, you can tell me a conjugation of a verb and I'll be like, okay, I got it. And I'll repeat it 10 times. And then like 10 seconds later, I'm like, wait, what was it? Yeah. So I'm with you on that. It's like, I love languages, but I suck at that. So you shipped yourself off to England after graduating. What made you decide to, if you're like, okay, I really want to work and study abroad, what made you decide to pursue that there? Had you tried to get a job domestically, or I should say in the US?
No, I wish I could go back to my 21, 22 year old self and ask, what were you thinking? That was very brave of you. I had a cousin that lived in London. And when I had been studying abroad in France, I spent New Year's here. So it was the year 2000. So it was a really big year. And as soon as I kind of came to London, I just felt really at home. And so it seemed like a great adventure. I knew I'd wanted to live abroad again from that experience in France. So I thought, I'll just try it. Yeah. And I arrived. It took me, I want to say, about 3 months to find a job. It was really hard. I remember feeling really down at the time. And I actually got two job offers. One was with Kappa. A program. I don't even know if you know that. One was a Kappa as a program assistant of some kind. And I remember going to their office, you know, near South Kensington. Yeah. And the other was with Chelsea College of Art and Design. And I decided to go with the university over the program provider. And I'm not sure why, but it was a hard decision, but I went with the university and had a wonderful experience.
And for those people who may not be familiar, Kappa is a study abroad program provider. I don't know if they technically would describe themselves as that, but they do internships, island program model. They have their own centers in several cities around at least the US, I think in Asia too. I'm not sure where they are located.
I'm not sure actually.
Go Google them. You'll find out, but they are a study abroad provider. So,
yeah.
Okay. So like, let's fast forward a little bit. So now you're working at the Chelsea College of
Art and Design.
Of Art and Design.
Which is now part of the University of the Arts London.
So
they have different colleges that have different sort of artistic things. The fashion, Central St. Martin's is really famous for fashion and things like that. So I've been working there and I made the interesting decision to move back to the US for a boy.
We all have to do that at one point in our lives. We all have to have a great love and be like, I'm following this person.
Yeah.
I need to be with them. So,
well, I did it anyway. Yeah. And so I ended up moving back to Santa Barbara, and I'm really glad I did. I met one of my best friends that I'm still best friends with today, and worked and applied for jobs at the Education Abroad Program, but the central office. So the University of California has a really large education abroad program. And at the time when I was working there, a lot of their programs were year-long or semester-long. People weren't really doing these short-term programs at the time. And the central office coordinated all of their education abroad program efforts from an office in Santa Barbara that was not on the campus. And that was for all of the University of California campuses. And I was a program assistant. And I'm trying to think of the countries that I worked with, but France was one. I think Germany was another. Russia was one. Interesting. Visas in Russia. I learned a lot about that.
Well, I was going to say, like, what was your job as a program assistant? What did that mean in this capacity? Because we all know the titles were like, what does that mean?
What does it actually mean? There was a program manager that oversaw particular countries and the different programs on the ground, because the EAP model at the time is most of those programs had offices there on the ground. So when I studied abroad, for example, at the University of Grenoble, they had a program assistant that worked full-time, but then they'd have visiting faculty that would take two-year posts. There's also California House in London, et cetera. And so as a program assistant, it was a lot of all the materials that would go to students, how to apply for visas, writing, researching that, and writing those handbooks, and then generally taking inquiries about what was going on. And I'll never forget, I got a phone call from a mother. Her daughter was studying abroad in France, and the Iraq war had just broken out. So it was 2003. Okay. And I'll never forget, the mother asked, I'm really concerned about my daughter going to France, because I looked on the map and Iraq is very close to France. I'll never forget fielding that call.
Compared to California? Yes, it is closer.
I know. But I soothed her and she was fine. But that's the type of work that you're doing. So yeah. A lot of the materials that go out to students, the handbooks, visas was big, writing the visa handbooks and how people apply for visas, etc.
I was going to say, like, were you applying on behalf of students?
No.
Okay.
Great question. Just writing, this is how you apply. You should do this. And then you should do this.
Which is so funny. Cause I mean, not that that was that long ago, but even like the early 2000s, I feel like writing a handbook saying like, here are the rules. And now we know, like, they probably have always been this way, but how quickly visa requirements and rules can kind of change on a dime. I know you've dealt with this a lot, especially in like the internship and tier four craziness of England. It's amazing to think that like there were like printed manuals, then the next in 2 weeks it could have been like, well, actually on page four, scratch out that paragraph. You don't even need that document, or there's a whole other addendum now where you need these extra things. How did you guys handle those kinds of shifts?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I think at the time, I think the tension that we had was making sure that we were working with all the different university campuses effectively. Mm-hmm. So they're getting all the same information because we were the central office. But I don't know about the shift from sort of hard copy to online, but also just the changes. It was a lot of phone calls. I think we were on the phone more versus email. So it was more in the moment phone calls. What do I do about this? What's happening with this?
I feel like we could do a whole other podcast episodes on the power of picking up the phone. Even today in 2021. And I know people are like, don't call me. I don't want any unsolicited calls. But I feel like we probably both have a lot of stories about like, and then I called them on the phone and things got resolved quickly. Okay. So you're working at the EAP office.
Yeah.
And I mean, my next question, I don't know if I'm skipping ahead. I feel like I know your story, but I'm like, maybe I don't know all the bits and pieces. But then I'm like, what happens next?
Yeah. So I had a friend in London who I'm still friends with, lives down the street. And she had sent me, she was really wanting me to return to London in the UK. And she sent me a job that she'd seen posted. And so I applied for it. And I FedExed my resume.
Yes.
And I learned later that that actually made a big difference. They were so impressed that I FedExed it. And so I had an interview with Tony Johnson.
Okay, that was going to be my question. I'm like, and when did you meet
I was working at EAP and was thinking I wanted to move back to London. Things weren't going great with my boyfriend at the time. So I thought, you know, I really miss London. I applied for this job. This is amazing, but it was a placement manager job. So it was working with internship placements in London. I applied, I got an interview, and I interviewed with Tony and Megan. Her name was Megan Basilius at the time. I don't know. I think she's
her married name.
And we interviewed on the phone and I thought it went okay. And at the end of it, I think Tony called me the next day, or I had another interview, and Tony called me the next day and he said, "You're terrible for this job. This is not the right fit for you." Yeah. Because I was new to it. I had never placed a student in an internship. Yeah. He said, "But we really like you and we'd like you to take a job in our Boston office, but we're not really sure what it will be yet, but it's working with all of our university partners. Does that sound interesting to you?" And so I said, "Yes, I'm interested to learn more." So I ended up going to a Ben Harper concert in San Francisco, and Tony, who lived in London at the time, happened to be in San Francisco and said, "Can we meet up?" And so the day after the concert, we met up in his like hotel lobby with all of his family upstairs and sat down, and there was no preamble. He just offered me the job. I said, "Yes." And it's crazy because this is youth. I said, "Yes," there wasn't a title. We weren't really sure what I was going to do.
Yeah.
And he said, "You have to be in Boston in a month." And so I had to quit my job and get out of my apartment and moved to Boston in a month, and I did it.
I love that story.
I know, it's crazy. So, and that role turned out to be the director of university relations for USA. So they'd had an office in Boston, and Catherine Hanley was there, and we together established this university relations office. And really, they were really new at the time. They were definitely in startup mode, and so just figured out and created how we worked with university partners and how we worked with all of our sites and how we made it all function.
Yeah. So I just wanted to be clear for all the listeners out there, because I've always gotten a lot of like, "Wait, what are you saying?" USA is EUSA. The original version was European Union Study Abroad.
I think it had two names. I think it had a different name in Spain because Aiden.
Right. Yes,
and then,
yes.
So it was, but it was European Study Abroad at the
European
time.
European Study Abroad. Okay. Okay.
And it just became USA.
USA. But I've had people, "Are you saying you suck?" Yeah. Like, "You jerk. I'm not saying." So yeah. USA, I think now they go by USA, but also Academic Internship Experts.
Experts. I believe that's correct. Yeah.
Thing now. Well, we don't have to litigate the history of USA, but sure. So you were there in Boston hustling, basically starting a brand new operation with Catherine Hanley, your partner in crime there.
Oh my gosh. Partner in crime. Love that woman. Love her.
So you had to do, obviously there was like the facilities side, like find an office. There's the hiring side. What do we need? There's the operational side. Like, how do we actually do this process of working all of those things? How long did it take you to kind of get to a point where you're like, "I feel like we've kind of got our shit together"?
Yeah. I was there, I want to say 4 years total, maybe 4.5, 5 years. And I think you, Brooke, came on board towards the end of my time there.
Maybe. I came on in January 2007.
Yeah. So I left the next year. Yeah. So, I mean, the beauty of it was that we did really have a blank slate. I mean, we didn't even have a spreadsheet, right? So we really started from scratch, which was wonderful. And it didn't take that long because of that, because it was so new. I'm really process oriented. So I wanted, Brooke, you'll remember this, you know, how do we send proposals to universities? What's our onboarding system for them? What's their journey? And I'll never forget, there was a conference where all of us USINs got together in Paris, and I just started, and Catherine Hanley and I went around the conference room with everyone with a water bottle that was a student and another one that was a university. And we just mapped it out. This is how we work with students. This is how we work with universities, with a good old water bottle. And so
that's awesome.
I know. So I want to say it was maybe 2.5 years where it felt maybe 3. I felt like when I left, cause I left to travel, I felt like I hope I left it in a pretty good space where there was still room for improvement, but we had the bones of it.
Yeah.
And a lot
of
this,
I'm not gonna lie. This is where our stories merge, as you mentioned. So Sam was the first person to hire me for my first big kid job. You were my first job offer, but you were the job offer I accepted. But this is not about me. But I was very excited. I remember my first impression. I was thinking about this before we got on, because I was like, I feel like Sam Cooper is such a force. I remember my first impression of you granted, I was like in a haze and a fog when I first met you. Actually, no, let's rewind. I was so excited about this interview because you offered me an interview. I was living in China at the time.
Right. Yeah.
And we had had this whole schedule to like have a phone because you had to call me. There was an earthquake where I was living and the internet was out and I couldn't even message you to say, because this is, I'm old people. This is like before smartphones and before I could be like, get on the what, you know, the 5G or whatever and message you. I just couldn't, the phones were out, internet was out. We had power, but like nothing else. And so I was like, oh my God, I'm never going to get this job. Like I didn't show up for an interview. And so when I finally got reconnected, I messaged you right away and was like, I am so sorry. Like there was an earthquake and you were like, yeah, no problem. And I was like, she's either like the most generous person in the world or she is really struggling to find somebody for this job.
No, I mean, these things happen. You were in China. I got it. At the time, if you remember, everyone, so those things happened. They still do, but they did happen.
Yeah. And then when I came in for my interview, so you offered me sort of an in-person interview, and I don't even know if they still do this, especially now, during COVID, if people are just only doing virtual interviews, or if we'll go back to like the in-person, on-campus, on-site stuff in the future. That'll be interesting to see. But yeah, so then you were like, okay, come into the office for an interview. And I was like, okay. And I was like, well, I'm flying back from China to the US on this day. And I'm flying into Boston because I flew out of Boston. Gotcha. And I was like, you're like, can you do it this day? And I was like, yes. And I was like landing at 7 a.m. I think my interview was like at 10 a.m. I went to my friend's, she was a resident director at Simmons College.
Yes.
So I like took a cab to her house, took a shower, gulped down like a billion gallons of coffee and like showed up like with coffee, which is so not professional. Don't show up with your own beverage to an interview. But I was like, I need this. So anyway, I just thought it was really interesting.
No, I remember
sitting across from you and being like, wow. Like I just felt you were so, and it wasn't like I felt it. I saw it. I experienced it. It was, you were so articulate and confident in what you had built. I just remember thinking like, I want to learn from this person. There were a lot of reasons I wanted this particular job versus other offers I got, but I was just like, I'm going to learn so much. And I'm not saying this because you're here. It's like, absolutely true. I mean, there's so many times in my career, I could probably think back and I was like channeling a little Sam Cooper juju is great. So thank you for hiring me and letting me learn from you.
Thank you. These are very kind words. And often I try and channel Brooke Roberts. So it's mutual. It's mutual. And I have to say, I've said it before, but I'll say it again. After your interview, after you left the room, I did turn to Kate Moore and say, I hope that woman hires me someday because you are very impressive in an interview.
I was probably like, I'm here to get shit done. And like so serious, like, oh my gosh.
And you do. And you do get shit done.
I do. That is true. So, okay. Yeah. Let's, you already hinted at this, but let's fast forward. Cause I think this is one of the really inspiring and maybe even surprising for people about your story. Like if you hear your story to this point, you're like, okay, she's making the move. She's like working her way up through the field, new titles, new experiences, new program exposure, all these things. And I don't know what was it you wanted to be when you grew up in international ed? You know, like, did you have like, oh, my eyes on this prize? You know, as you said, you were at USA for about 5 years and decided I'm done. What made you take this next step? And what was that next step?
I wanted to do something else. I felt like I'd reached a point with USA where I wanted to gain more experience in another organization or setting. But actually, I also was young. I was 28 and I was in Boston. Remember, I meant to go back to London. So I was in Boston and I just felt like, what about my travels? What about me living in other countries? And so I quit to travel and that is legitimately it. And I think it was before, people do this all the time and they were doing it at the time, but I remember getting a lot of people saying, I can't believe you're doing this and traveling on your own. I got that from a lot of women where I don't think you'd get that today. I think people would be like, yeah, of course you're traveling. I just wanted to travel and I wanted to keep learning and I wanted some different experiences. And some of it was, I wanted to keep learning, like I said. So, and I'd also kind of had a romanticized view of teaching English in another country because you had done that. And, you know, the other people I knew had done it had great experiences. So I just thought it would be great for my career anyway, but also selfishly, I just wanted to do it for myself. So I quit my job. I gave notice, don't worry. We put all those plans in place. Yes. And I just went, I bought a one-way ticket to Guatemala. And I had three goals, thanks to Catherine Hanley. She said, you got to have goals to stay on track. And I said, great. And so I wanted to learn Spanish. I wanted to volunteer and I wanted to get certified to teach English. And so that was kind of my guiding principles. So I started in Guatemala. I started learning Spanish. And then I went to Buenos Aires and I did a TEFL program and got a certificate and started teaching English there and thought maybe I would stay, but then ended up getting restless and wanting to travel. And so kind of traveled back up through South America. And that was about, I want to say 8 months. Went back for Christmas, saw some people. I think I saw you. We did see each other in Boston. We have pictures, proof. Mm-hmm. And then I had always wanted to go to Nepal. I went and volunteered there for a month, visited some friends in China. I also went to Hong Kong. And then I thought my Spanish in Guatemala, I'd learned sitting across from this amazing guy named Pedro, but never in a classroom. We just sat for hours on end looking at each other and talking. So I didn't really have any written stuff. I just learned it from talking to people in Buenos Aires. And then Argentina is like a whole other accent. So I was over the place. I was all over the place. So I decided I'm going to go to Spain and I'm going to do a semester of Spanish lessons and classes. I was the oldest one in the class. It was full of a bunch of kids doing gap years. They were all 18, 19. I turned 30. So I was sitting in there with all these 18-year-olds. Ended up kind of traveling through Europe. And then I just got really tired because you do and thought I should really make some money now and go back to work.
I've spent it all.
I've spent it all. And you know what? A lot of that was funded. Obviously, I saved up. I did teach English and work. But all my airfare was covered from the hustle of USA. So doing all of those flights around the US and abroad for university relations, I had all those mileages and points, and that's what I used to get around the world ticket and stuff like that.
Yeah. Podcast episode idea. We should have some road warriors, others on the, and we could talk about like how to squeeze the most out of all that travel that you have to do as a road warrior.
Great idea. Yeah. Yes, please.
Yeah. Let's do it. Stay tuned for that, ladies and gentlemen. So I love that you did that and that you made that investment in yourself. And I don't know, obviously I'm biased. Everybody knows this, but I feel like that experience, frankly, like even for me, like even though I'd taught English abroad, the whole idea of like actually traveling around, I was always inspired by you doing that. I think also maybe right before that, another woman, Megan, she had gone to do a month or 3 months or something volunteering too. And she also was leaving the company. And I was just like, I want to do that. How do I do that? And which inspired me in many ways as well. And, you know, I think it is really powerful because later on it took me basically, I don't know, I want to say maybe 10 more years before I did something similar, but I had my own company by then and could work from anywhere. But I just think as international educators, the idea of at some point in after you've had some experience in the field, you've been on the ground working with young people, making the, you know, in administration, you know, really understanding the inner workings of what we do. I think we can also get kind of jaded or have a lens about the experience that is only rooted in administration of the experience or our own experience from when we were in college or when we did a gap year when we were really young. And I feel like we should all be required after 10 years working in the field, you have to go invest in your own meaningful travel experience again, whether that's like a month studying Spanish or, you know, volunteering, whatever you want to do. Because I feel like the experience of being a participant changed so much from when I studied abroad as a young person to now, like what it's like to like land in a foreign country and navigate that experience. But there's also new types of challenges, I think, as well. Like some parts I think are easier, but there's some parts are also now harder. And I think for us as administrators and people spearheading the future of these types of programs, we really need to understand, like, what is it actually like on the ground? We might think it's going to be these things, but what is it truly? And I think the fact that you invested in your own experience for your own, you know, personal growth and development is, I think, number one, most important. But then also now you get to take a whole new perspective of, like, what it feels like to land in a new place and figure out your life and how you're going to function and all the things, which is probably very different than when you landed in Grenoble, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I think we all need to mix it up every now and then, but also just put ourselves back in that vulnerable place of, you know, that feeling right before you land in a plane and you're going to a foreign country. Maybe you have plans for that night, but you don't have the next one. That feeling, I think we all need to be reminded of that scary little feeling that.
Yeah. Cause I know I like, even, you know, when I was still, and even after go abroad, when it's just been my own businesses, it's like, yeah, I mean, I've traveled for conferences or consulting projects in different parts of the world, but it was all like work related. It was like funded through work, and we've all been there. It's like, oh, you're going to go to forum conference in Europe. And it's like, you didn't have to invest your own hard-earned cash into like making your own experience really valuable. Yes, there's other motivations for making that a valuable trip as well. But I just think, yeah, there's nothing like you like saying, I'm investing in myself and my own experience. I just think that's really powerful. You came back, you're like, I want to earn some money. I'm tired.
Yeah.
Did you feel like you had a better sense then that of like what you truly wanted to do in the field? Did it give you a better self-understanding of like, oh, here's where I think I want to be?
That's a really great question. And it's interesting looking back on it now. I thought coming back from traveling, and this goes back to just the culture shock and that of being on the road and then and coming back to the US in lots of different ways. Coming back to the field, there was culture shock there. I really thought I wanted to focus more on meaningful travel and service learning and things like that, which are still very important to me. My initial idea when I came back to Boston was to just apply for jobs and get a job back in the field or work in sort of a nonprofit space, especially from volunteering. I'm still really passionate about education, but wanted to maybe impact different communities and have more of a positive impact. I think that all got lost in the very real reality that it's really hard to get a job in international ed. And even though I'd had pretty good experience, I would say, it was almost impossible to get back in without taking a huge jump down. And also, I got told over and over again, I didn't have a master's degree, so I wasn't a valid candidate. I got that told that a lot. So I would be, I can't lie, it was a really rough transition back from traveling. And it really felt like I derailed my career in some ways. But I don't mean that in a negative way. It was one of the best things I've ever done. I would never change that. But I was surprised. I was legitimately surprised at how difficult it was to get back into the field, given how much experience I'd already had. Mm-hmm. And even the experience I then continued to do while I was traveling. You know, it wasn't really time off. I wasn't on a beach getting drunk. You know, that wasn't one of my goals, you know,
I want
to keep growing.
If anything, you upskilled in so many ways.
Yeah, that was the idea. And I think I was young. I was curious. I wanted to see what else I could do in the field. I spent some time job hunting, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it took me about a year to find the right job. I had some temporary jobs. I had the wrong job that I quit. Best thing I ever did. and I ended up taking a more travel position with Babson College as their first BRIC program coordinator. So they had a BRIC program, which stands for Brazil, Russia, India, China. And the program, it didn't go to Brazil, but it went to Russia, India, China, and India in that order. And so I took that job and really grateful for it. It was a great experience. But that took me back on the path of working at universities. So I did that for, I think it was 6 or 7 months. And then luckily they had an opening for a study abroad advisor and I took that job. And that's when I realized that study abroad advising is not for me. I thought it would be. I was legitimately interested when I took the job.
Yeah.
But I think what I loved about working at USA is the amount the different programs and universities and people and students that you could interact with. You know, it wasn't one university, it was several. It wasn't one program, it was several. I love that part. I love being in that space of working across different programs.
I don't want you to have to like relive the struggle like too much, but I feel like so many people who listen to this podcast might feel like they are in that right now, especially for our field right now. And whether it's like they don't have enough experience and they're being told, or they're overqualified, they have too much experience, the type of job they're trying to get. And so, or, you know, all the things that you kind of just mentioned, they might not have a master's degree, but tons of experience. Were you also limited because were you fully focused on Boston, like the surrounding region, or were you doing a nationwide, international UK jobs? What do you think there were other elements that were limiting you beyond just some of those other elements you mentioned?
100%. Okay. And it was Boston. I was focused on Boston at the time, and that was very limiting. There's a lot of universities and colleges in Boston, but it's also really competitive. So that did limit me, and I wish I had looked further afield, but then I did. So in that process, you know, I was very lucky to get the study abroad job. And then an opportunity came up to go back to USA to do a maternity cover. And that was perfect because as I'd been there, I realized I need to go to grad school. I wanted to go to grad school. And so that's when I made that decision. So I'd been 12 years out of undergrad to go back to grad school. And because I wanted to, it was also something like travel. I thought I really should do this. Everyone I knew had a master's degree. So there was definitely peer pressure. But I also, I like learning. I'm a lifelong learner. So I thought it would be really interesting. And so once I, that's the path that it then took me on. But if I had opened myself up to further afield and outside of Boston, I think it would have been easier and it would have opened up more opportunities.
But I also imagine like just knowing you and knowing what you built at USA and just your personality. I'm like, there had to been like so many providers that you could have easily been like, hey, I'm looking. They would have been like, where do we sign? Take all our money. We're going to hire you.
I mean, I don't know if I was as networked then. I mean,
really with USA?
A little bit, but maybe with universities, but not with other providers.
Right.
I think from that experience, I've joined local associations and got really involved. So you are forming those relationships with people across the aisle, as it were. Mm-hmm. But no, it was rough. It was rough out there. I think it's rough all the time.
Fast forward a little bit. So you decided to go to grad school. I know you went to Portland State University. You decided to do a master's in public administration, which might surprise people because everyone's like international ed. What made you decide to do that type of program? And we've already done an episode about grad school, so go listen to last week's episode where we can dive deeper into the grad school thing. But for you specifically, what was it about Portland and this program that made you go, this is for me?
I heard amazing things about Portland, Oregon. I'd been back in Boston for a while. I just finished a relationship. I was ready to leave Boston. Always these relationships, my friends. They're always coming.
We're either
in.
Running to them or running from them.
Right. I wanted out of Boston. I had a really good friend in Portland, Ann Haberkern. I'd heard about a program that was related to service learning. I didn't end up doing that program, but that's how I got interested. There was a NAFSA conference, I think in Vancouver. So I took the opportunity to visit my friend in Portland, visit the university. Her husband had been doing a program at the university as well. So she just walked me through, here's the program, this is what you should do, et cetera. And I just liked it. I like Portland. And I knew I didn't want to study international education. I'm more of a practitioner. And that's why public administration really appealed to me. I wanted to learn something new. I wanted to learn how organizations function. I was really interested in nonprofit management. And so that's what led me to the NPA. Degree. Yeah. It was a 2-year program.
What are the things from that program? Like what are two like big things that you feel like you learned that have been serving you well now back in a career in international ed?
Great question.
I sprung that on you.
No, that's fine. No, it's good. It's a good reflective question. I did have an amazing class around higher ed administration. It wasn't a core piece, but I remember that being, I just geeked out on that. And, you know, I would do things differently a million times. I think we all would, you know, maybe I should have studied higher ed administration, something else. What I liked about it is it reminded me of what students are going through, how to be a student. It made me a better writer and critical thinker. And I met some amazing people in that worked and studied in this nonprofit space and international development. And I just learned a lot from them. But it also pushed me back to international ed. It made me realize how much I love international ed. My thesis was on how to build a culture of study abroad at Portland Community College, where I was also working at the time. And I just liked the idea of studying universities from a business perspective and also learning from people and practitioners. It was very practical based, and that worked really, really well for me.
That's awesome. All right. Home stretch. Well, sort of.
Well,
we still have so many twists and turns to discuss. So I hope you guys are ready. Hope everybody has a glass of wine or a warm cup of coffee. So you finished grad school, and I'm sorry if I'm glossing over anything other big happened during grad school, but you finished grad school and now you have another like round of like, you want to get a job now as a result. Yeah. So before you tell us what happened and where you went, what was the application process like this time, now that you had those elusive letters behind your name?
Well, you're going to hate me because I only applied for one job. So what happened was, it's not what anyone wants to hear, but I actually think it's a good lesson. So I was in grad school, I was finishing. I was supposed to finish, I think, in March. And I got a call from USA because they were hiring for a London director. And I was planning on staying in Portland. And they invited me to apply. It was a lot of soul searching. I wasn't expecting it. I applied.
Wait, before you say like any more of the details, I feel like we need to paint a little bit more of a picture of what was happening internally in USA. Cause I feel like if somebody doesn't know, they might hear like, oh, so just your old friend Tony Johnson was like, hey, job. So that's not, it's the same company, but a whole new cast of characters involved.
That's right. Yeah. Tony Johnson was no longer part of USA. So it was the director of operations at the time, Terrence. We'd met from my previous stint in Boston doing maternity cover. They were hiring for a new London director. They knew I had dual citizenship. They knew I'd worked at USA before. And I applied and I got it. I had to finish grad school early. So it's finished in March. I ended up finishing in December. It was a rush to the finish line. I still feel my body is healing from that process because they needed me to start in January. So I finished in December. I think I had, Christmas and then had to pack up my life and move to London. So it's definitely one of the better decisions I've ever made. It was really hard to leave Portland, Oregon. It's an amazing place, but it felt like a big kid job. It was a site director. It was managing 10 people. I was scared. I think I would have been stupid not to be scared. I think those are the jobs you have to take. I was also ready. And it really pushed me into this sort of definitively into this area of work-based learning, which I knew I liked from working at USA years before, but I'd never been on the delivery side. It was a happy mistake, I guess, or a happy coincidence that I ended up going back to them and then really, I think, kind of finding a really true vocation of helping students in their careers that I'd always liked and talked about, but this was focus on it.
I will say, and I'm not an expert on Sam Cooper, but I'm pretty close. And I feel like just having seen and working with you on the university relations side of like communicating, like what is the program going to look like on the ground? But we weren't actually the ones working directly with the students and making the placements and seeing you operate in that world. You're so good and so great at those relationship developing and like, I still am not good at it. I'm still trying to learn from you. But I think now, as I've worked with you now on the internship placement side or the work placement side of things, both with Inside Study Abroad, seeing the work that you were doing with all these other places, I won't spoil it. And then what you're doing now, I'm just like, oh my gosh, like, yes, this woman is, you are so good at it. I'm sorry. I'm not here to just like puff you up, but like, you are so good at it. Like I couldn't have asked for a better person to partner with on our own internships for the Global Pro Institute, because I'm just like, I could never do it that well. and you're just, and you love it. That's what the thing is about it. Is I was like, you're not only good, but you love it. That process. Yeah. And I'm like, don't make me have this conversation. You're like, I'll do it. I love it. I want to do it. I truly see that in you too. I don't know if you mean to do that, but you do exude that energy of like, this is my ish. Like I am in my zone of genius. I love this stuff.
Yeah. And it's crazy. Cause I'd obviously been flirting in the world of internships.
Right.
Since 2003. I mean, that's what USA does, you know, internship programs. And so that's kind of where I started and cut my teeth, as they say. And so it's funny that I thought that whole time thinking I needed to be somewhere else. I think that was necessary. I think that's why people should do work experience, because you have to try things to know you like them or don't like them. Uh-huh. But I really feel like I did land in a zone where I feel useful and helpful. And I feel like I'm constantly learning. I love learning about different companies and how different people function and the projects they do. And it's effectively just, you know, getting people to talk about themselves and learn all about them. So yeah, so I came to London, landed, and I think I had a week, and then started a brand new big kid job, as I like to say.
Which you've had before, which I think is so funny.
Before. I think it'd be silly not to admit that everyone feels this way. I think in every next job you have, there is the fear factor. And I think if you don't have it, then maybe, you know, you're not reaching kind of high enough. Yeah. So I was at USA for about a year and a half, and I noticed that there was an opportunity with the Academic Internship Council, which was the organization. So Tony started with Aidan Hayes USA. Then they sold it, I want to say in 2013, and started their own offshoot called the Academic Internship Council, which was then bought by CIEE, and they were opening a London office. I was really annoyed that they didn't contact me to let me know that they were starting it. But I realized after the fact it's because they had a non-compete, so they couldn't contact me. So I remember,
that makes sense.
My email to Kate Moore, and we finally talked. I was like, Kate, why didn't you tell me? She's like, we can't contact you.
She's like, you have to come to me, woman.
Yeah.
That's a really, I love these insider little nuggets. That's so fun. Yeah. But you reached out to them. And so then it was fair game.
I reached out to them to say, because I hadn't heard from them, I was nervous that, well, maybe they didn't want to hear from me. Right. So, and obviously I'm friends with Kate Moore. We've kept in contact. So I reached out to her to say, would you welcome kind of an application from me? And we had a chat and talked about it. And then I ended up applying. Still can't believe they said yes. I'm always surprised. It's very weird interviewing with people you know.
Oh yeah.
So, you know, we had an interview process, and then I was offered the job over a glass of wine. It's the best job offer.
Oh my God. Those are the best. I just submitted a big like consulting package proposal to a company who it happens to be run by someone I know really well. And so it was just half the time I was just like, kind of giggling when I was doing my little presentation and like saying, breaking down the project proposal for him. And I was just like, do we really need to do this? Like,
I know.
But yes, you do. You do need to do these things.
You do have to do it. Yeah.
But it was just also very weird. Cause I'm like, I don't know. We've gotten a little tipsy together. Like this seems weird.
That's just international ed. You've been tipsy with most people.
Yeah. So basically you were running an existing office with USA, and they had a team and staff and probably some operational things, not to say that you didn't improve upon those
systems.
There
was stuff there. Yeah, absolutely.
But with AIC, now you're jumping into doing something very similar, but like starting one from a blank slate. So I feel like we understand what that is. What I want to know from you, what did you improve upon now that you got to start your own version of the USA experience in London as AIC? What were some of like the two things that you're like, I'm absolutely changing this. I'm absolutely keeping that.
Yeah. Great question. I think the very first thing is you absolutely have to keep strict processes with students, because they're there because of the mistakes that previous people have made. I think everyone should know that about international ed. There's a reason there's policies and procedures, because the every one of them is because a student did something drunk or did this to an employer or something.
Right.
Like there's reasons there.
Right.
So I definitely kept the process of how you know we work with students. I think one of the big things I definitely wanted to change was our relationship with employers, especially in the UK and London. It's a very networked place. And British people, they build relationships through, you know, going to the pub and having a coffee or a drink or things like that. And so the big thing I wanted to do was actually bring the reality of the business world into the reality of international ed. You know, these students, yeah, they're studying abroad, but they're also going into someone's business. And so I really wanted to make that link stronger. So we started adding events for employers, receptions, and even talks that were for students, but that the employers would find helpful. So bringing in speakers, because it's all a part of the ecosystem of industry and education. And I that was something I just, it just felt right. And I think that works really well. And those are things I'd continue to do. And, you know, on the student side, again, processes, but also be a little bit more upfront and human with them. You know, I think one of the big things I advocated for in the process of when you first meet a student to talk about their internship interests is to be honest with them and say it. We're going to have an open and honest conversation. You do not yet have the experience to do what you want to do, but why don't you do this first? Because then your next experience will set you up for that. And students need to hear that. We all need to hear that because it's not doing them any service to say, sure, I can get you an investment banking internship. No, I cannot. You've been a lifeguard. Therefore,
and you've taken three classes in finance. Yeah.
Right. So let's get you that first one. And I think we had that was one of the things I felt important was these are students, they're humans. Let's be accessible to them, but let's also be honest. I mean, the struggle is often real. It sounds easier than it is, but
yeah. Well, that sounds amazing. And I'm sure we could talk more about because you've done it now several times. We could do a whole other episode. Maybe we will about what it's like to just start from scratch. But I feel like now we're getting into something that's more recent and raw. So now AIC, so when you joined AIC, were they already part of CIEE?
Yes.
Okay.
I think for a couple years by then. Yeah.
Okay. So you've basically at this point joined a startup / inside of a very big, established behemoth of an organization.
That's correct.
I'm trying to say things that aren't negative, but also describe it's an old dog. It knows its tricks. It's not learning new stuff.
It's a big organization with, thousands of people. So it's a lot different than working in a 20 person organization.
Right. What was that kind of transition? Just even going from more of the tiny company to a huge brand and organization in our field.
It's funny because at the time, that's what I wanted. I wanted to move to a bigger organization because I thought it might have more stability, which makes me giggle now. Oh, the things we think in 2016. And I thought it would offer more opportunities to grow, move into different roles, et cetera. After setting things up, that would have been interesting to me. They have a global presence, et cetera. I think the reality is very similar to any study abroad organization of any size is that there's the office in the US and then there's the offices in the different cities and locations, and they fundamentally don't always talk to each other or have an open channel of communication that makes sense because we're dealing across cultures. So that was a surprise to me to not know who are we working with, right? Who am I working with the people in London? Am I working with people in sort of headquarters? But that's just also figuring out larger organizations. So I think I realized I liked being in the smaller, more agile startup division of a larger company because I could still do what we needed to do to act quickly and I think innovate faster. But then you still had the stability of the larger organization. But the processes in the bigger are rough,
The
bureaucracy and also just who can help me on this. Sometimes took a long time. Who's the right person?
Right.
It was harder to get answers to questions. They took a lot longer.
Yeah. So it's February 2020. Running the CIE London internship program.
Yeah.
Am I describing that correctly? Yeah. And at what point were things starting to heat up either on the ground as delivering the programs with students on the ground / internally with, am I going to have a job kind of conversations?
Yeah. It's funny. I think for everyone, if you look back, a year ago, I think even, a few weeks ago, I thought, wow, I remember how quickly it happened, and it did happen really quickly. So February wise, we were kind of business as usual. The only difference is we'd moved some of our programs in China, for example, to come to London. People were trying to pivot and offer, you know, Chinese language classes in London, so people, students could still travel but not go to China. But it all happened very quickly, and it was a 2-week period of time. There was a sort of global conference call or Zoom call where we learned that we would have to make some drastic cuts. So I think we learned on a Friday, the anniversary just passed. So last Friday, actually the 26th of March, was when we all found out we'd lost our jobs. But the week before, they said there's going to be about 75% cuts. And then the following week is when they announced on Zoom that the AIC division had been
disbanded.
I can't remember the word they used, but discontinued or
shuttered.
Yeah. And that was it. And so that was Friday. We stopped working.
And just to clarify for everybody, if you're tracking with us, this is CIEE, one of the largest companies in the meaningful travel industry. They do inbound, outbound, J-1 study, like all sorts, volunteer, all sorts of types of things. So it's a huge organization, not just study abroad. And they ended up laying off 75%.
I think
70?
The initial was around 75 to 80%. I think it was 700 people in that first. I think I know they went on to make further cuts. So I don't know what the ultimate cut was, but it was massive. Yeah.
What was that like for you?
It was horrible. You know, I'm managing people at the time, and it's horrible to have, you're going through it while your staff are going through it, and you just have no answers for them either. Mm-hmm. It was also a hectic time for everybody. It was a low point. I mean, I'd never want it to happen to anyone, to be perfectly honest. I also felt bad. You know, my boss was Kate Moore at the time. She just found out, and she had 2 weeks notice. But us people outside the US, it all depended on the country you were in. So we were very, very lucky to have government support here that helped us get through that. But effectively, we stopped working on the 26th of March and never went back. It's crazy. It was
so abrupt. I remember we kind of reconnected and we started like Zooming every day. It felt like we were on a Zoom call every day, just chatting. Not, and it wasn't work related. We're just like, how's it going? What's going on? Yeah. I just remember every day it was sort of like, and we got this email and then, I got to go get my thing out of the office and whatever, you know, it's like, it was so, so crazy. And I know a lot of people listening may have had a very similar type of very abrupt ending, which is so, so sad. And I know that a lot of people were making some really, really hard decisions as well. Yeah. It's not just, obviously if you still have your job, you're lucky and good for you. But also I know that's a hard thing just internally to have to decide who do we keep?
Impossible. Yeah. And I feel for people on both sides because it's also horrible to lose a bunch of colleagues and be left. And it was rough.
And this is going a lot longer. Thank you everybody for listening in and tuning in with us this long, but Sam has just such a wonderful, amazing story and hopefully you're enjoying it. If you are, leave us a rating and review. I hardly ever ask that anymore, but leave us a review on iTunes. We'd like to hear from you. So Sam, you got laid off from CIEE or furloughed. I'm not sure what the technical term was for that.
Yeah. I mean, the division, they eliminated the division. I think that's the word they use. So I didn't have a job to go back to, but in the UK, they had a furlough scheme. So it was like a delayed redundancy or however you would call it. I had some money coming in from the government, but I knew I didn't have a job to go back
to. Right. Okay. And so now you have to decide like what's next and getting a job and all the things. So I'm just going to fly through this part. In many of our conversations, we talked about how I was always like, I wanted to have an internship component for the Global Pro Institute. And she was like, I love that stuff. And I'm like, that's great, because I don't want to do that stuff. and it was like a perfect mind meld. And so now Sam works with me inside of GPI, kind of as her side hustle, I would call it. And she manages the internship component of the Global Pro Institute program. But in addition to that, you also went through a job search process. During a pandemic, all online. Can you describe a little bit about what that looked like? What did that actually look like logistically? Like, what were you doing?
Well, first I panicked severely.
I didn't want to mention that part.
No, let's be really honest, everyone. I had a kind of an extended anxiety attack, which I think we have to be honest about this. It is scary to lose your job in a pandemic. I would be lying if I said I was fine. I wasn't fine. It's really, really hard. I also knew that it was going to be a good opportunity. And I know that sounds crazy, but I had already been thinking about moving on from AIC and CIEE. And so in some ways there was a little bit of, this was the kick and it's terrible timing, but here we go. We have to do it anyway. And it is scary, you know, I'm like the head of household in my family with my husband. So it was a real thought of where's the rent coming and how are we paying our bills and things like that. But I think one of the things I immediately leaned on was just the network. I just started talking to people, and people that I knew and trusted and I could be open and honest with, and I didn't have to pretend. And that's where I had the amazing opportunity to work with Brooke again. I mean, I've learned so much from you over this year. It's crazy. When's our year anniversary, friend?
I don't know.
And now.
I'll have to go back and look. It's been at least a year.
Yeah.
Or maybe just that
we started talking. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, but those conversations and talking to people about projects really kept me going. I contacted some other providers just to see if, you know, freelance work would work. And then I posted on LinkedIn. And from that post, someone at the University of Roehampton that I knew in the study abroad area.
So what did you post specifically?
Oh, I posted to say, really to celebrate AIC, because it had come to an end, and it was that group of colleagues was such an amazing, inspiring, smart, motivated, innovative group of people. And I was sad, you know, it was a good group of people to work with. And I felt like I was constantly being pushed and learning, and I wanted to celebrate that. And so I posted that and shared that I was on furlough, because that was the term we were using in the UK, and didn't explicitly say that I was looking for work, but people in the UK would know. I did a British post, right? It was very understated. And so I had just met someone at the University of Roehampton study abroad office in January, because we were maybe going to be working together with some of their American students. And he saw that I posted and immediately messaged me. So the power of also kind people, and said, I know our placement team is hiring. Would you like to meet the head of placements? And I said, sure. And I had a conversation, not really intending to apply, but I really liked her. And we had a great conversation and I applied. At the same time, I applied for one other job in study abroad. Never heard back from them. Never heard back.
Ooh, I really want to know who it was, but I won't make you say.
Not even an acknowledgement. And then talked with people. So from that experience, it was a lot of networking and chatting with people, and applied for two jobs and then got one of them.
Okay. Right. So. Well, do you mind talking a little bit about like your, because we had conversations about this,
yeah.
So kind of leading you in this question a little bit, because I kind of know the answer, but because I know it was kind of a hard even decision, like even when you got the offer, because the nature of the role, the salary, the title, the responsibility level was, it's kind of going back to when you came back from traveling, where you're kind of opportunities that weren't really matching your level experience, all these things. I don't want to say you took a step down, but there were some considerations, like
being
a director of the London internship program for a huge organization. And then this role that was truncated, I would say, comparatively. How did you make that kind of decision? Yeah. Or was it just like, it's pandemic, I'm taking a job? Like,
I mean, there's a mix of both. I talked a lot about it with friends. I talked a lot about it with people that I had been in similar situations. The consideration for me, it was a pay cut for sure. It was less responsibility. I had been managing people. I'd been running an entire office. And this was a very focused job. I wasn't managing people. It had a very clear directive. And I realized through talking with people that this was the right decision for me at this time, because it was quite traumatic to lose my job. I'd also personally been through some trauma over the past couple of years, and maybe just needed to focus on a job where I liked the work and I could grow with it. And that's the big piece. In talking with my future boss, now boss, I knew that there was room to grow. And that was very clear in our conversation. It was very clear in the interview and the job spec that they put out. So I knew there would be opportunity. And so it was taking a risk at future opportunity. And I'm really, really glad I did. Also getting back into a university, which in some ways is more structured, has more stability, hopefully. Yeah. You never know now.
Yeah.
But those were all things that I weighed up. I liked the people. I liked my boss. I liked the work. Mm-hmm. It was setting up something new. So I knew I was in my zone, right, of capability. I knew I could do that. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't an easy decision. It took me a long time to get to that point. I was going to say, I think there's still people struggling with that. You know, it's okay, I think, to make lateral moves or moves down if it's helping you get on that next S curve, right? This mm-hmm. this curve is going to keep going up for me. And I know that. And that's why I made that decision. Because really my S curve with CIE was coming to an end. So I just had to, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I love that. Ooh, if you're not watching this interview over on our YouTube channel, she just did a little squiggly that showed you exactly what that was all about. So you have to go watch on the YouTube channel. A couple of things you mentioned there that I wanted to follow up with is, one, we haven't actually said, like, where do you work? What's your role? What are you doing now? And which I should have probably led with this. Sorry, everybody, if you listen this long. what are you doing now?
So I am the Senior Placements and Business Engagement Manager at the University of Roehampton, specifically working with our Roehampton Business School postgraduates. And actually, I just got a promotion. So I knew there would be growth, and I got some growth. And I am hiring, so I will have a team soon. So my risk paid off. But effectively, what I do is very similar to what I've done in the past, work with students to help them on employability, their own employability and career development. And I also work with employers to help match them with students that want to do a placement as part of their degree. So internship placement, we say placement here in the UK. Mm-hmm.
And which is also what she does inside the Global Pro Institute. So you guys are getting a true pro here if you join. And then the other part I wanted to follow up with kind of a theme I heard from what you just described, and making that decision about this role at this stage in your career. As I think for those listening, I think it is really important when you're evaluating an opportunity, any kind of opportunity, is you also, one of the factors you always have to include in that evaluation is like the season of life that you are in. And I think oftentimes we're so focused on like all the things, and you know, we talk about it here on this podcast and we will continue to talk about it. We talk about the networking and gaining experience and upskilling and all those things that you should be doing. But there's also that other X factor of like, what's going on in your life, like outside of your time and energy spent on work, what does your life actually look like? That your life and your career are going to go through seasons. And there might be seasons in your career where you're just like, I'm taking anything, I'm being scrappy, I'm getting all the experience, I'm going to be on every committee and volunteer for everything with the national organizations, and I'm going to do all that. I went through a season like that where I was like, all in on all the things, all the places. And then there are going to be seasons of your career and your life where it's like, you're not as interested in that. You're wanting to focus your energy and time on other things that might not involve work. You might have things that are not intentional that pull you away from focusing on those things. That's great. I think if those things are happening and you are seeing these S curves happen in your career and your life, that means you're living like a full life. That's great. I think if everybody's in a season of hustle and grind and like, I'm just growing my career all the time, there might be a big piece that you might be missing to feel well-rounded and more whole, versus like also the people who are just like, nah, I don't really care about my career and I only live for joy. Although now that I say that out loud, I'm like, those people sound great. but I will never be that person, but yes, they sound great. But there will be times where your work and your career is less of a focus. And I think it sounds like you went through that kind of evaluation where it's like, you know, this, you know, with entrepreneurial friends, we kind of always joke about how it's like, we would be horrible employees in one sense, but also amazing employees on another sense. Cause if we're just like, oh, you want me to do one thing? You only want me to do a thing? And so like with you, you know, you went from running this larger operation and managing human capital and all these other things to being like, I know my lane, I'm sticking in my lane, I could do it really well. And then I don't have the, you know, extra stress and extra responsibility and ownership over all these other mechanisms to make our office run. There's somebody above you that does that, yeah. Which is so can be very liberating. I know we talked about this, but you're like, you know, I forget how many years you were at UC London and then AIC/CIE, but like in that, 4 years? It's like you were hustling.
Yeah. 5-6 years. Yeah. It was six years. It was five and a half years. Yeah. And it's crazy now when I think about it, because I'll never go back. You know, it's really hard to work with students on their careers and employers when you're also doing housing and health and safety. And you're talking to a student that feels maybe suicidal or is having a really hard time and mental health issues. And then you're on
call. Emails from parents
and you're on call and the drunk student, you're on call with the hospital and the program administrator at 4 a.m. because the student got drunk and threatened to sue the emergency technician that came over to help them. I mean, these are things that legitimately take away also from focusing on maybe certain aspects that you want to focus on. There's nothing wrong with that. If you want a career that has all those aspects, then please be a site director in delivery of study abroad. Yeah. It's really amazing. But there's also a time for me when I just wanted to focus on the things that I really love and really, really learn and pour more of my resources into that area.
Yeah, I love that. So we're coming to the close here. And thank you so much for sharing your story and being willing to. I know I was like, how about we interview you? And you're like, okay. So I'm really happy you agreed to do this. But Sam's going to be on the podcast moving forward. We're going to be batch recording a bunch of great episodes coming in the future. So stay tuned for that. But Sam, if people want to connect with you professionally, where would you like them to go?
I would love for you to connect with me on LinkedIn. So Samantha Cooper. I love LinkedIn. Please send me a connection request. I love a note. So just send a note. That's the best place to connect.
Yeah. And she's the queen on LinkedIn. I always tell people to connect with me on LinkedIn and then I log into LinkedIn once a month. So
there every
I'm
day.
Worst. I'm worse. But Sam will be there to say hello and greet you. So thank you again. So we have some announcements for those of you who stuck with me. A big announcement is the Jason Kinnear, who is director of international programs at the university. How do you say it? UNC Chapel Hill, but like, how do you say it?
University of North Carolina
at Chapel Hill. I'm like UNC Chapel Hill. That doesn't everybody know? University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And I've known him for a long time. He's had this awesome career in international ed and study abroad specifically, but he's going to be teaching our education abroad advising lab in early May. So that is actually available for enrollment right now. We have early enrollment pricing and that'll be happening early May. So if you want to learn more about that, go to insidestudyabroad.com/lab. So we will also link to it in the description and show notes below. Beyond that, we also have the Global Pro Institute opening for enrollment again for our spring cohort. So Sam and I will be working with a new batch of aspiring global educators in the next enrollment. And that is happening at the end of April. So if you want to make sure you're on the email list for that and our early enrollment, early bird pricing period as well, go to insidestudyabroad.com/ISA. No, don't go there. Sorry. Go to insidestudyabroad.com/GPI. Too many acronyms. So insidestudyabroad.com/GPI to get on the wait list if you're interested in enrolling in the Global Pro Institute and internship program. It's been a lot of fun. We have a lot of people who want interns and we don't have enough interns. So if you want to be involved and get an internship placement, definitely sign up for that. So thanks again, Sam, and everybody for listening in. Remember that every day you postpone a dream, you weaken it a little. So get out there and make some magic happen.
Are you looking to accelerate your career in global education? Well, I've got a solution for you. Introducing the Global Pro Labs Certificate Program. This is our online skills-based training that teaches you the foundational knowledge and core functions of global education administration. From education abroad advising and management to international student and scholar services, international admissions, program development and delivery, and marketing, each lab will teach you everything you need to know to hit the ground running in that specialty. Each lab is taught by thought leaders and scholar practitioners with decades of experience in their area of expertise. Join over 150 students who have gained the foundational skills needed to thrive in a global education career. Best of all, you can get certified without having to get a master's degree right now or attend an expensive conference. Ready to get started? Head to insidestudyabroad.com/labs. That's insidestudyabroad.com/labs to enroll today. I can't wait to see you on the inside.